today with Truth News Radio on the 19th of November 2016. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great to have you with us today. In today's show, I am going to be investigating a word that is very important to understand in the context of where we sit now in history, and that word is liberalism. I'm going to be looking at liberalism as a concept and the different forms of liberalism that have occurred and the words that are used for these different forms of liberalism, such as classical liberalism, social liberalism, and neoliberalism. And I'm also going to try and probe into the umbrella concept of liberalism itself to understand what it is. Before I kind of get into the general thrust of what I want to say in today's show, which is that I believe a certain type of liberalism, and I'd probably call that social liberalism, really has reached the end of its shelf life. It has basically become unworkable. It's over, right? And this concept of social liberalism is one that I want to put quite a bit of focus on, but I need to explain it in the context of the broader concept of liberalism. And when you get into this and you start looking at it, you start understanding the history of it, you realize that a lot of the time people have concepts of the meanings of words that they've picked up from other people they've spoken to, the news media, the odd book that they've read, but they don't really have a grasp of the history or the etymology of what the words really mean. But of course, in a language like English, which is so rich and diverse, meanings are changing all the time. And so it's fair to have different connotations or different interpretations of meanings. But if you don't have the understanding of the history, you'll tend to have a bit of a myopic grip on what these words truly mean in a cultural sense. And just to give you an example of that, a lot of people, especially in the United States, think of liberalism as being related to socialism and consider liberals to be left-wing people. Whereas in fact, liberalism in its classical sense is quite different. And you could almost say it's the opposite of socialism and left-wing thinking. But it evolved over time with different colouring to be a word that was used by people of the socialist orientation. And we'll get into more of that later, but I'm just trying to give you an example there of how it is that a word becomes sort of bastardized over time. But it is very important to understand that what we've seen, particularly in 2016 with the election of Donald Trump, I believe spells the death knell of a certain type of liberalism. And it's the type of liberalism which is driving a lot of people round the bend. People who are intelligent, aware, awake, find so many of the ideas of modern liberalism to be, or the mentality of the people who subscribe to that, to be almost bordering on insane. And I want to give a couple of examples of that in the show today as well. But let's begin with liberalism itself, in its purest sense, to understand what it is. Liberalism is a political philosophy. And I'm just reading a clip here from a paragraph here from Wikipedia. Liberalism is a political philosophy or worldview founded on ideas of liberty and equality. I'll just read that again. It's a political philosophy or worldview founded on ideas of liberty and equality. Now, the wellspring of those ideas is generally understood to be the 17th century, actually no, the 18th century, the 1700s, leading up to the French Revolution in that period from around about 1700 to 1789. This is also known as the Age of Enlightenment, and it was a further evolution out of the Renaissance, which was in the previous century, when a lot of rich ideas and learning and resurgence of interest in the classical past and knowledge from the classical past became imbued into European culture. And then in the Age of Enlightenment, we had the birth of quite a new and unique approach to life that involved a much deeper intellectualism, and it saw the rise of science, the scientific method, with people like Francis Bacon and René Descartes. You also saw the birth of profound economic theories like those of Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill. And you saw political philosophy, philosophies about questions of how people, how society should be structured, the concept of liberty and the rights of man in the writings of people like John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire and David Hume. And these are all very famous figures from the history of philosophy and political philosophy and economics. And they all form the intellectual foundations of what is termed liberalism. Now, it's a very big topic, and of course I'm not going to try and probe into any of these figures in any depth. But let's just take that as the basis and understand that these were deep philosophical ideas and very noble and far-reaching concepts. And the emergence of these ideas in society and the fact that they were championed by powerful intellectual forces was part of the major impetus which led to the French Revolution. And, of course, the French Revolution was one of the most, you know, epochal events in modern history, because it really was the first example of a major radical change in the overt political order based on some of these grand and quite noble ideals of freedom, égalité, equality. The emphasis on the individual rights, which again really denotes the movement of society away from a theocratic or feudal structure to a structure where the individual is kind of the most important and the most central force within society to determine how society should progress. So the rights of the individual, the freedom of the individual are crucial to the concept of liberalism. And out of this general philosophical concept of liberalism, what evolved in the 19th century was a doctrine which has become known as classical liberalism, which is kind of putting into play some of the ideas of liberalism in terms of creating a society based on a social contract, one wherein there was a limited amount of government and government for the purpose of maintaining basic law and order to prevent people from engaging in a kind of war against each other, as Hobbes had declared was the nature of man, Thomas Hobbes, that there was the state of nature in which human beings were kind of at war with each other. The role of the state was to create a level playing field, but to give maximum freedom within that for individuals to pursue their own interests and what they called laissez-faire economics. Now, with that as my brief introduction, I want to play to you now a little bit of a lecture on classical liberalism. And I don't have... this is This is from YouTube, Nigel Ash Ford, PhD, George Mason University. So I'll just play a little bit of that, and then we'll get more into the some of the deeper concepts of that, and I'll be playing you a couple more clips. So we'll begin with this. What is classical liberalism?
What is classical liberalism? It's a set of ideas that places the freedom of the individual as its central feature. Classical liberals disagree about many things, but they agree, I think, on 10 core principles. Number one is that liberty is the primary political value. We all have lots of different values. We care about our family, our church. But when it comes to deciding what to do politically, what should the government do, classical liberals have one clear standard. Does this increase or does it reduce the freedom of the individual? The government should only act to prevent harm to others. Second principle, individualism, that the individual is more important than the collective. We should not sacrifice the interests of individuals for what some people argue is the common good. This was the central feature of communism and fascism. The individuals didn't matter. Every individual matters. Every individual is worthy of respect. Third principle, skepticism about power. Power is the ability to get other people to do what you want that otherwise they would not do. Government, for example, often claims we're forcing you to do X because it's in your own interest to do so. Whereas very often, when people with power do that, it's really because it's good for themselves. Classical liberals believe that the individual is the best judge of their own interests. We can try and recommend things, but in the end, the individual is the best judge of their own interests. Other people should not force them to do things that they do not want to do. Fourth, the rule of law. This is the idea that there are some higher principles by which we should examine what government does, laws that are passed, government actions. Just like the US Supreme Court will sometimes strike down pieces of legislation that Congress has passed and the president has signed because it goes against certain principles embodied in the US Constitution. Classical liberals believe that certain principles of the rule of law should be applied to what every government does anywhere in the world. A classic example is equality before the law. People should be treated the same regardless of their race or gender or sexual orientation. That's why classical liberals have always objected to the idea that there should be laws that treat, say, blacks and whites differently. Five, civil society. Civil society are those voluntary organizations that exist between the individual and the state. Classical liberals believe that most social problems can be more effectively dealt with through these voluntary organizations, like the family, like the church, like charitable organizations.
We are just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about the concept of liberalism today. Do stay with us. Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio, and I'm talking about liberalism today, trying to kind of get a fix on it, to understand a little better about what liberalism is. Of course, it gets savagely attacked from many angles these days, and quite rightly so, but when people attack liberalism and criticise it, they really need to understand what it is they're criticising, and it's very important not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, because although much of liberalism has become terrible, that terrible part of it forms around a kernel of things that libertarians actually hold very dear and that are very, very central to the US Constitution. And I'll get onto that shortly with another video clip with an individual who talks about the the connection between the US Constitution and the core concepts of liberalism. But let me just finish here with this lecture, a few more minutes, on the basic principles of classical liberalism. And we're up to point six at this point.
Six, spontaneous order. Order, it means the existence of regularity and predictability in the world. When people are making decisions about what to do, they need to be able to predict what the results of making those decisions should be. Many people seem to assume that order requires some institution, somebody, to manipulate and organize things. Classical liberals don't believe that. They believe that order can arise spontaneously. People, through their voluntary interaction, create the rules by which people can live by. Classic example is that of language. Nobody invented the English language. It arose in terms of people communicating with each other, and yet certain rules have applied through that process. We don't need people to plan our lives. Seven, free markets. That economic exchange should be left to voluntary activity between individuals. Government should not tell people what to where to work, how to save, what to build, what to produce. This should be led to voluntary interaction by people. You need private property to be able to do that, and you need to ensure that when there is disputes, they can be peacefully resolved.
I think we'll just leave it there, because there's more other stuff that I've got to cover in this show. But you can see here that the core concepts of classical liberalism revolve around voluntarism, voluntary behaviour, the enshrining the individual and the rights of the individual as being essential to a civil society. And it's quite simple, and yet from that a lot of complexity can develop through things like spontaneous associations and the organic process of individuals pursuing their own interests within a framework of law that does limit and does impose restrictions to some extent, but those are restrictions based on a moral code that we can all agree on. Now, I want to get into talking a little about the US Constitution, because the US Constitution was deeply grounded in these ideas. And when you understand that, you realize that, yes, liberalism really is the key to our most cherished concepts about human freedom and what civil society really is. But those concepts have been eroded in later times with a new interpretation of liberalism, which has kind of been grafted on the top of that, but we will get into that. But let me just continue now with a clip here from an interview that was done on the Rubin Report, Mike Rubin talking to Randy Barnett. And I've just paused the video here at a point where he's starting to get into the concept of the rights of the individual as enshrined in the Constitution and the significance of that. Here we go.
It really comes down to the individual person, and that the state should not infringe on your individual rights to do what you see fit within the laws.
Yeah, so when I say first come rights and then comes government, I do mean first come the rights of individuals. The Declaration of Independence, which was the founding document of the country. Then we had two tries at government. But to make a country, the Declaration declares the country we are. It says that all persons are endowed with certain inalienable rights, among which are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Each one of those is individual rights, mm-hmm. life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And the next sentence of the Declaration says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So it tells you first come rights of individuals, then comes government to secure these rights. The entire philosophy of the country and the Constitution are summed up in those two sentences of the Declaration.
Yeah, so our founding fathers really were individualists at heart, right? I mean, when they were framing this entire thing, and when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, and then when the Constitution came, their whole concept was that if we can take care of the individual first, that the government will have to behave in a way that will always respect that.
Yes, first come individuals, first come rights, but individuals are not atoms. They were not atomistic individuals. Neither do I believe contemporary libertarians are atomistic individuals. The reason why we have rights and the reason why we need rights is because we do live in society with others, and rights are the way that define our jurisdiction as opposed to our fellow citizens' jurisdiction, the way nations define their jurisdictions so that one nation doesn't interfere with the internal affairs of other nations and we don't get wars. Mm-hmm. That's what rights are for. In society with others, each of us needs our own jurisdiction to make our choices, and that jurisdiction needs to be defined relative to other people's welfare as well. So we are individuals, but not atomistic individuals.
Right. So let's back up to the Declaration of Independence for a second, because the line about the pursuit of happiness, there's some comic that I heard do a funny bit, I can't remember who it was, but that line, that we're the only country that has something like that, that you're here to pursue your own happiness, that puts a lot of pressure on us, that we're supposed to pursue happiness, where a lot of other governments, they don't really exist to have us pursue happiness. They give, you know, it's to pursue the government's means or to make more product or something like that. So that really is a unique line that our forefathers put in there that really has helped spread freedom, right?
Well, it's the ultimate end. I mean, rights themselves are not ends in themselves. Rights are the means to the pursuit of happiness while living in society with others. So libertarians and classical liberals generally, though we believe in individual rights, do not believe that rights are the end of everything. Rights are simply a means by which individuals are able to pursue happiness without unduly interfering with the ability of other individuals to pursue happiness as well. And that formulation by Jefferson was not unique to him. George Mason, several weeks before the Declaration was written, George Mason wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and he also put happiness and safety as the ultimate end. The pursuit of happiness and safety is the ultimate ends of society.
Yeah, when you think about the people that wrote these documents, and then you look at our political system today, we'll get into them later, so let's not go too deep on what's going on today.
Don't depress me this morning. It's a beautiful sunny day in L.A. I'm at the Chateau Marmont, and now you're going to try to bring me down. Don't bring me down, Dave.
I'll bring you down in about 20 minutes.
Okay.
But for now, let's focus on just those specific people, the founding fathers, really. I mean, do you consider them that they were modern-day geniuses, really? Or was it just a function of they were escaping a monarchy, basically trying to create a system, and that it was sort of thrust upon them? Or maybe there isn't one answer. It depends on each particular person.
I mean, I really don't know the answer to this. I don't think I've ever been asked this question before. But I would say they are better educated than we are. That I don't think they were geniuses. I don't think they're natively smarter than we are. I just think they have a much better education in both their primary education and in college. They read all the classical writers, and they just knew more facts and they knew more theory than we know today, than most people today. You know, we watch our TV and we watch reality TV. We watch, we watch the wonderful dramas that are on TV. I don't want to knock TV. I'm actually big on TV, frankly. I'm a big TV guy.
Always been. A lot of good stuff on now. Nobody's.
I became a lawyer because of The Defenders, which was a television show that came out in the 60s. So I'm totally big on TV. But the truth is, we're not as well educated. I certainly didn't get learn in high school what I could have learned, and I didn't even learn in college what I might have learned. They knew more. They weren't better people than we are by any means, but no. They knew more.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about liberalism today. Stay with us. A lot more to come. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm playing to you a clip here from the Rubin Report, an interview with Professor Randy Barnett, Professor of Law. And he's talking about the US Constitution in the context of the philosophy behind it. And I'm actually relating this back to the essence of liberalism. And he's talking about the founding fathers of the US Constitution. And of course, they grew up in the era of the Age of Enlightenment, as I was talking about earlier in the show. And they will have absorbed, as part of their learning and reading, all these great writers and philosophers of that era, Locke, Descartes, Rousseau, Voltaire, Hume, Bacon, Adam Smith, right, all of these people who are great intellects and formed the basis of a new way of thinking about society. And they were very well educated, as you're saying, and this went into the concepts of the US Constitution. I'll play a little more of this interview, and then I want to get into talking about social liberalism, which was a later evolution of liberalism, which takes it in quite a different direction. But let's continue now with the interview here on the Rubin Report.
Right. Okay, so let's back up to something you mentioned, which was classical liberals and libertarians. Now, I would consider myself a classical liberal, and I've watched what I think is the sort of destruction of the left over the last 2 years. It's been very sad for me, and one of the things I've been talking about a lot on the show. What is the difference to you between a classical liberal and a libertarian?
Well, classical liberal is a larger category, and libertarians are a subset within classical liberals. They're not different things. One is a more narrow subset. Libertarians, I think, the difference is libertarians believe in a few basic sets of rights, of individual rights, and the more radical a libertarian you are, the less you think need to be added to that basic set of rights in order for society to do well. So there's the right of, you know, property and contract and self-defense and restitution. These are the basic rights that people have. And the more radical libertarian you are, the more you think we can just get by on those rights and we shouldn't add anything else. And Then people think, oh, well, no, you need this and you need that, and you need this other thing. And then that makes them somewhat less radical. But as long as they believe that the core of society is the individual living in society with other people, so there's a society as well, as long as they believe that these individual rights are the core and that in some sense first come rights and then comes government, then that puts you in the liberal tradition. Mm-hmm. And we call it the classical liberal tradition to distinguish it from the term liberal, which got taken over by the progressives. When progressives got a bad name after World War I,
right?
Because progressives, they had their own, they were called progressives, and then They got a really bad name associated with World War I when Woodrow Wilson, the famous progressive, is locking up dissenters and putting Eugene Debs behind bars, who was the socialist candidate for president. It got a bad name, so they started calling themselves liberals, because that was a good thing to be called.
Right.
And then they gave liberals a bad name. So Then we can't call ourselves liberal because they call themselves liberal.
Yeah. Don't you hate the label part of it? Because I find that to talk about these things, we need these labels. And yet at the same time, nobody really wants to be labeled. And it's usually limiting because a lot of us have things that bleed into the other categories.
Well, I went through a phase in which I didn't call myself a libertarian. I called myself a classical liberal. And in fact, the Institute for Humane Studies, who, you know, is sponsoring this or has something to do with this video, They had that as part of their thing, which was we were liberals, we were classical liberals. And I found it confused people. And they would say, well, what is that?
Yeah.
And it would make me seem like I'm defensive, like I'm hiding what I am. And I finally realized, you know, libertarian actually doesn't have a bad valence anymore. It used to be really weird. I'm old enough to remember when the term was like really weird.
I think it still has a bit of a weird connotation to the masses. I mean, did you watch, I'm sure you saw it, or maybe you attended, the Libertarian Convention? It was quite a show.
Well, I saw it on live stream.
Yeah.
And I thought it was actually well conducted. I didn't see the part where the crazy people came
on. The guy with no, you know, but I think stripped that was, on stage.
Yeah, I didn't see that part.
Yeah,
I think most of it was much more serious and business.
Okay, I'm just going to leave it there. I think that section of the interview was interesting in the sense that the professor there explained some of the problems of terminology and some of the difficulty in defining who you are due to the evolution or the corruption of language. But that is really what language is all about. Language is constantly being corrupted. And so you have to reinvent terms and words and meanings to keep up with that. But in this show today, what we're trying to do is we're trying to track and understand the ideas behind the labels. So we won't get too bogged down in the words. It's just this is a way of starting to talk about the subject matter. And I'm now going to talk a little about social liberalism. And this is something that comes up if you start Googling and you get into Wikipedia. You'll find liberalism branches into these different subgroups. And we've got the classical liberalism, which I've been largely talking about up till now. And we've got social liberalism. And then we've got neoliberalism. And neoliberalism is a bit of a head trip, and I don't even quite get it, to be honest with you. I will try and explain to you what I understand of neoliberalism. Social liberalism is a little easier to grasp because you can see how it evolved. Now, just reading here from Wikipedia, social liberalism is a political ideology that believes individual liberty requires a level of social justice. Like a classical liberalism, social liberalism endorses a market economy and the expansion of civil and political rights and liberties, but differs in that it believes the legitimate role of the government includes addressing economic and social issues such as poverty, healthcare, and education. Under social liberalism, the good of the community is viewed as harmonious with the freedom of the individual. Now, social liberalism in modern times, in its application, has tended to become equivalent to what we call the nanny state. And of course, the nanny state connotes this idea of the state as being this benevolent force which intervenes in every different aspect of life to, as they say here in Wikipedia, to address economic and social issues. But it goes beyond that. It goes into every aspect of life. And it's almost as if it's a reaction against putting trust into the natural, spontaneous ability of individuals to make decisions and create civil society that is decent and harmonious. It says, no, wait, we can't just let that go along unimpeded. We've got to put some rules around that. We've got to put some restrictions here, some coercive factors there to basically herd people into the direction in which we want them to go. And in this concept of herding people, this concept of treating people in a collective sense, again, is very intrinsic to the new evolution of liberalism that we see in recent times. And it certainly has a lot in common with collectivist mentality, and it certainly borrows a lot from the concepts of the greater good. You know, it may not appeal to you that we have a certain rule or a certain law, but it's better for the entire community. But this leads to a lot of injustice and what many consider to be tyrannical intrusions on people's freedoms. And I was talking about the herd there a minute ago, and indeed the herd concept is one which is used in healthcare in regard to vaccines when they say that they have to build herd immunity. And the state intervention in people's rights and freedoms in regard to vaccines is a perfect example of how this excessive concept of the state intervening in order to protect or to maintain a level playing field has just gone way too far. And let me just iterate through quite a few concepts, and you'll see it goes on and on. It doesn't, in fact, it's hard to know where it ends, because once this concept of intervening is taken up by governments, they extend it in every direction. They even extend it into international relations. We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It is a great pleasure to be with you today. We'll be back for one more segment. Don't go away.
happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And today we're talking about liberalism, and I've been talking about classical liberalism. I'm now talking about social liberalism and what actually began with an idea which seemed reasonable in the late 19th century and really took off around the time of the Great Depression, which is that there had to be a safety net. We couldn't just rely on the total laissez-faire economics to solve all problems. And the welfare state, for example, was a positive, or some would say a benign example of social liberalism to guarantee a safety net for everyone so that you wouldn't starve to death if you couldn't get a job. But it didn't limit itself to that. It didn't limit itself to just offering people things. It also included intervening and restricting what people could do or companies could do, and sort of coercing and corralling people into certain behaviours, and with laws and threats, you know, behind those laws. Now, I mentioned just before the break there about vaccines. There are a lot of things to do with healthcare that have become quite coercive. I mean, you have people who want to investigate their own form of medical treatment for cancer, for example, come up against huge problems. For example, some of the treatments for cancer are actually illegal, and even though many people claim to have cured themselves of it. And, of course, if you've got a child and you want to pursue a non-orthodox method of healthcare, you could end up coming up against the law as well. As a parent, you could be charged with neglecting your child because you don't follow what the state-sanctioned method of healthcare is. So the whole area of healthcare just goes on and on and on. It becomes quite ridiculous. Now, the environment, this is another one, which you may not immediately recognize it as such, but the environment protection has also become another form of state intervention. And it's become a basic platform of the left. And you might wonder, why is environmentalism a basic platform of the left? Why do we have the Greens and the left coming together on the environment? Well, because it's all about interventionism. It's all about coercive pressure to be made in a collective sense to protect the environment, which ends up being imbued with some sort of concept of rights in the same way that individuals have rights. It's like the environment has rights, and it's like endangered species have rights, and we are led to believe that we must protect the environment in the same way that we have to protect individuals. And this actually can lead to the individual's rights being subjugated for the benefit of the environment. And that's, of course, exactly what carbon taxes are all about. And if you look at the rhetoric and the whole ideology behind climate alarmism, it's really about reducing the rights of individuals for the sake of the right of the environment, which is supposedly for the greater good. But in many cases, it's not going to be something that you're going to be able to see the benefit of, but you're told it's for the greater good, and you have to believe it. So in the environment becomes another way in which social liberalism has manifested itself as a political ideology, environmentalism. But it doesn't stop there. And, of course, we have market intervention, wealth redistribution, which, of course, is well known, and various forms of wealth redistribution, the main one being the graduated tax system, so that the more money you earn, the more you're taxed. And the idea behind that is that it redistributes money from the wealthy to the poor. But, of course, it it provides a disincentive for people to ever really succeed, ever really do very well. It provides a sort of a tall poppy syndrome for the entire society to prevent people from being able to realize their full potential. And this is, at least that's the criticism of it from a libertarian perspective. And I should say libertarianism, and as was explained there in that interview that we heard recently, libertarian is a subset of classical liberalism. But let's talk a little about foreign interventions, which I sometimes go by the name of war. I mean, this is like intervening in other countries for their own good, because it's for the greater good, even though it might involve dropping bombs and killing thousands or even millions of people. The same arguments are used, and there's even a meme that was put out, and it's been used in the UN. It's called Responsibility to Protect. And this hasn't actually been fully ratified in the UN, but there's a lot of pressure to have it kind of ratified as a treaty that countries have to sign up to, that countries have a responsibility to protect people in other countries who might be suffering from terrible regimes where they're being tortured and oppressed. But of course, in reality, what this becomes is a mechanism for countries or groups of countries with the sort of stamp of approval of the UN to go in and to engage in hegemony, to invade other countries, to control them, to subjugate them, all under the banner of, you know, it's for the greater good, you know, we're protecting you. So this is what social liberalism has become. And it's become a nightmare in recent times. It's led to all these contradictions, you know, almost in a purely Orwellian sense, where we've got, you know, war is peace. You know, we've got invasions of other countries for the sake of peace, and where we've instituted measures that are increasingly enslaving us and saying that that is about protecting freedom. This is literally happening. And we see the effect of that on society, on individuals in many ways, as actually creating a kind of a mental dissociation, a state of mind which is bordering on some sort of mental illness. And I've just got a short clip here from Paul Joseph Watson talking about Sweden to give you an example of that, absolute proof that liberalism is a mental disorder. Here we go, Paul Joseph Watson.
If you want a glimpse of what happens to countries when they embrace the mental disorder of extreme liberalism, look no further than Sweden. And no, this is not a hoax, it's not satire, it's not out of the Onion. This is a real story. Socialists in Sweden want to tax the population to pay for returning ISIS terrorists to get jobs and reintegrate into society. Örebro Municipality Councillor Rasmus Persson wants to offer psychological help to enable jihadist militants overcome traumatic experiences they may have suffered while fighting in Iraq and Syria. Sweden's official coordinator against violent extremism, Mona Sahlin, wants to take the idea nationwide and impose a tax aid for immigrants who fought with ISIS, taxing citizens to pay for the reintegration of violent nutcases who behead people, throw gays off buildings, and stone women to death.
I'll just leave it there. I think that makes the point clearly, that this type of philosophy has led to a state of mind which is so confused, so deeply confused, and it leads to a state of mind where people would even endorse such a ridiculous thing. But it also leads to a state of mind where people simply project their prejudices onto individuals based on what they're told and what the identity politics of the time says, for example, about Donald Trump, and they say Donald Trump is terrible because he's a racist and a sexist and he's homophobic. And then you look at the actual information that's available and you find, well, there's no evidence these are racist. There's really no evidence these are sexist. There's no evidence these are homophobic. But the meme was created, and it's so powerful that people don't even care. It's like the mentality of those who subscribe to the liberalist mindset is one wherein you get programmed with a meme and you run with it. I just want to give you another example, which popped up recently, which I found interesting, an example of the same sort of madness. Shark nets in Australia are being opposed by many left-wing groups, and they say that the shark nets are it's unjust, you know, that the shark, because the sharks get caught in the net and the sharks die, and other marine creatures get caught in the nets, and they're basically saying that shark nets shouldn't be allowed, and they say that they aren't effective when in fact the data shows that shark nets are actually quite effective. They're just not 100% effective, but they certainly do reduce shark attacks. But the whole business of shark nets has become a massive campaign for the left in Australia trying to protect the sharks. And we have a lot of people who get killed by sharks every year, and it's not a joke. It's a very serious problem. And to see these people lobbying to prevent measures that would protect them and their families, again, there's a slight madness in all of this. Now, we are at the end of the show, and unfortunately I didn't have time to get into the subject of neoliberalism. But from my understanding of it, what neoliberalism represents is kind of a move back more in the direction of 19th century liberalism. It's got negative connotations now because people associate neoliberalism with laissez-faire capitalism, and they blame the 2008 financial crisis, for example, on neoliberalism, and it's associated with people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman. So neoliberalism is now mainly used as a pejorative term by people of the left, and it would be held up as an example of everything that that is bad, and people like Michael Moore would say, you know, neoliberalism is responsible for the decline of American standard of living and various problems like that. Unfortunately, we are at the end of the hour. I hope you've enjoyed my little excursion today. I will be back next week with more research and ideas. It's been great talking to you. That's Truth News Radio Australia, signing out. See you next week.